We're ready for argument in the case of Martinez versus the people. Petitioner may proceed.
May it please the court, Andrew Hare. My registration number is 16891, and I represent Arthur Martinez. I intend to first address why the express right to appear under Article 2, Section 16 of the Colorado Constitution should be granted greater protection than the inferred right to be present under the Confrontation Clause of the Federal Constitution. Then I intend to proceed to why, regardless of the court's decision on that particular point, this court should extend the rule in Griffin versus California to the exercise of this particular right, as it has done in so many instances in the past with regard to so many different constitutional rights and including a statutory right. Following that, I'll probably, if I have time, I would like to address some fair trial and sound trial practice concerns, and then finish with why the error in this case requires reversal. The right to appear in the Colorado Constitution is explicit, and it's not the right of confrontation. The right of confrontation appears later in the same section. And so under common rules of interpretation, it must be granted something more than simply being redundant or superfluous of the right of confrontation. The federal right, as it is understood under, for example, Illinois versus Allen, is the right to be present during trial, and that's the way it's described. The right to appear in Colorado attaches throughout the criminal process. It includes every aspect of the criminal process. So those are those are distinctions that the court should be aware of when it decides textually whether or not to grant it greater protection. In terms of text differences, this court has frequently relied upon textual differences in order to arrive at a decision that a Colorado constitutional right will be granted greater protection. I've cited to the tattered cover case. I think it's interesting that in that particular case, based upon just a nuance in the First Amendment versus the Colorado constitutional right to free speech, of the federal right being represented in the negative versus the Colorado right in the affirmative, that the court went on to grant greater protection to that right, employing or implementing a particular balancing test to ensure the protection of that particular right. So based upon just the textual difference and the explicit reference to the right to appear, and then the knowledge that that right includes more than simply the right to be present during trial and confrontation, the court should, on that basis alone, grant it greater protection. There are historical considerations as well. Again, the people of Colorado ratified a constitution knowing that there was the right of confrontation, which would necessarily at that time under federal law include the right to be present. But they decided to ratify a constitution that included something more than that and meant something more than that.
So how does the something more than that that it would have if we agreed with your argument specifically relate to any difference in addressing the particular issue here?
Well, this is, and I'm glad you asked that, because here's the rub, is that the state, in this particular case, the prosecution made a generic attack on Mr. Martinez's right to be present at trial and having been present during the course of his trial. But the right to appear and the attack on that particular right would not be limited to the slippery slope the state wants the court to go down, is that this right to be present or to appear during the course of the criminal proceedings, according to the state, at least at trial, the basis of his knowledge, as the state says, was informed by his presence. So the right to appear informs the basis of the accused's knowledge throughout the criminal process. And the appearance is including hearings, statements of counsel, the court, other witnesses, other instances in which the right of confrontation may actually not even attach. But nevertheless, the exercise of the right to appear informs the accused's knowledge and basis of knowledge when he takes...
But the right to confrontation does protect the right to be present at trial.
Correct.
And the considerations, it would seem, with respect to that aspect of the confrontation right, seem hard to me to understand how that's any different from protecting the right to be present. I mean, it seems that in that respect, you're talking about the same thing, the right to be there in the courtroom when this goes on and how this affects it.
Well, as Mr. Martinez's position is, it's not limited to that. In other words, the state's view is not saying that the condemnation...
What's the expansion when it concerns the right to be present during the testimony?
Well, it's not just that, though. And that's the right we're talking about under the Colorado Constitution is not limited to that. And so by extension, if the court were to basically disavow decades of authority where the court refuses to allow...
Let me ask this differently. How are the aspects of the right to be present, which are not limited to being in the courtroom during testimony, impacted by what occurred in this case?
Well, in this particular case, factually, there is nothing. So if I'm following the court's question and concern, the attack is baseless. So it's not, and the danger here is that without having to have any particular factual basis or evidentiary reason to explore the exercise of the right, whether it's at trial or at some other time.
Isn't that the same analysis that you would use with the confrontation right?
Same analysis insofar as how...
Concerning how the right was impacted.
Well, the impact, if I can move now to the cases that the court talks about or has issued with respect to exercise of rights, is that, and the Griffin versus California rule, is that it's a chilling effect. If the accused has knowledge, which Mr. Martinez did not, that one right will be used against him should he exercise another, that chills the exercise, for example, of the right to testify. If the cases also basically provide that the damage is in condemning the exercise of the right, is inferring guilt from the exercise. It's ambiguous. It's inherently ambiguous. There's no reason to believe that an innocent person hasn't exercised that right any more than a suspicious person or a guilty person. And so the damage that the court has been unwilling to even allow in any degree is that it won't allow condemnation or comments on the exercise of rights. Another example of keeping in line with what the state is arguing is that this is the basis of the accused's knowledge at the time that he testifies that allows them to talk about or condemn the exercise of the right and to raise with the jury the specter that he's had an opportunity. The opportunity also is present when he uses his lawyer, as he's entitled to, in preparing for and sitting at table during the trial. That actually occurs in front of the jury as well. And these are things, and as regards the right to counsel, this court has not yet announced that the prosecution cannot gain an advantage or damaging effect by commenting upon the exercise of right to counsel. Court of Appeals has in Lucero, but this court hasn't. So the slippery slope that the state is asking this court to now change course after decades of refusing to allow this is that these particular rights are now going to be at risk. And this, the exercise of them alone will be enough for the jury or allow the jury to infer guilt.
Well, can you give me help me out with the facts? Now, the defendant testified at trial, and the comments about tailoring were made in closing argument. Is
that
right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And weren't there objections and some sort of comments by the judge at that point?
That's correct.
How did that go? Could you?
Yes.
The tailoring comments weren't made when he was testifying, right?
There was a question asked of him, which was not objected to, which was basically in the nature of you've had an advantage to sit here. That was it. There was no cross-examination. In other words, the prosecution bringing up instances in which it believed that Mr. Martinez had actually tailored or shaded his testimony one way or the other in his favor because of what he'd heard. In closing argument, the prosecution, it was in final summation, after defense counsel had gone over the evidence in the case, keeping in mind it's a bar fight, you got a bunch of people, and they're giving their views of what happened. The prosecution basically alleged that he has had a right, an advantage that nobody else has had. He's been able to sit here and listen to the testimony. And defense counsel objected, it was overruled. And in response at that particular time, the prosecution said, I'm allowed to talk about that he's not credible, thereby attaching directly the exercise of the right with the notion that that's somehow indicative of his lack of credibility. The prosecution repeated it again after the objection was overruled. There was another objection, it was overruled again, and closing argument was finished.
And there wasn't, I thought I remember the judge made some comment to the prosecutor, like move on or something like that, or if that's wrong.
In terms of telling the, the court did say at the end of making some comments about the constitutional rights at issue here, let's proceed. But it didn't really, it certainly overruled the objection. It did not cure what had just taken place.
Mr. Hare, the only part I didn't understand about the record was the court's comment at the very end of that, where it said, he said, defense counsel is making another objection again, and the court said noted, and I'm sure the jury also noted that the detective was present. Was he trying to suggest a tit for tat, or what was that about?
I believe that in response to, it might have been the initial objection counsel had mentioned, or maybe in that particular objection, that the detective had also been present during the trial.
Right, but I understand that from the record, but why in your opinion did the court say that? Was he trying to suggest, well, the detective was present and the defendant was present, so judge both people's credibility equally, or what was the point of that? I'm assuming the detective was probably present as an advisory witness, or what was that all about?
Well, I think that it was trying to equate that they're the same, but they're not, because the detective does not have the right to be present necessarily as a constitutional matter. So to equate those is not is actually accurate, constitutionally speaking. And to do so, the detective was not relating the events of the night in question, whereas Mr. Martinez was, and so the credibility attack.
Did the judge say anything in addition, or by way of clarifying or limiting or instructing the jury, other than what we've seen in
other
the briefs?
Other than accounting that Mr. Martinez had certain constitutional rights, the court did not tell the jury that they could not infer guilt from the fact that he exercised it, and as I said, overruled the objections. Briefly, with regard to
Mr. Hare, sorry to interrupt you, but could you, Assistant Attorney General makes a point of arguing various facts in the defendant's testimony that support the generic tailoring argument that you make, that the district attorney made in rebuttal. Can you just discuss your view of the record? And then secondly, is it in your view necessary for reversal to find a constitutional right was violated by what happened?
Well, with respect to the record, what counts is what actually occurred, which was an attack on the constitutional right to be present. The state, after the fact, relating what it believes to be instances in which Mr. Martinez's testimony fit or tracked other testimony of other witnesses who are relating the same event is not indicative of anything, and it certainly wasn't what occurred at trial. If it were persuasive, effective, impactful, the prosecutor below would have mentioned it in closing. She would have brought it up in cross-examination of Mr. Martinez. She did neither of those things. So what the court or what the attorney general can glean from the record now is really irrelevant in terms of deciding whether or not what happens with this particular error. Yes, the error should be, even if it's not constitutional, reversal should occur under the harmless error rule, because in this particular case we're talking about a we're talking about a credibility contest, the epitome of a credibility contest about what occurred on the night in question during this particular bar fight. So on that basis, I think the court should reverse the conviction and remand it for a new trial. See, my time's almost expired. I would like to reserve whatever time's left for rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court. John Thirst for the people. There is a threshold issue here that this court needs to address in terms of the constitutional question, and that is whether it was preserved as a state, as a question of state constitution. I mean, we have a long-standing rule in Colorado that when there's an objection, and assuming it's a constitutional objection, we presume it's federal, not state. Here, there wasn't a defense counsel, he himself didn't even raise the constitutional question. The prosecutor said, and this is what started things here, is, the defendant's had kind of an advantage, hasn't he? He's been able to sit in here the whole time and listen to what everybody had to say. Defense counsel objected, said he's entitled to sit and hear the trial. He didn't say my client has a constitutional right to sit here, nor especially here did he say my client has a right under the state constitution to sit here. He didn't quote our state constitutional provision. He just said he's entitled. Now, the court construed that as a generic constitutional right, and I think that's probably fair. I mean, and so the court said, ladies and gentlemen, the defendant obviously is entitled to sit in his own trial. It would be clearly unconstitutional to prohibit that. Didn't say unconstitutional under the state constitution.
Yeah, that's a pretty fine point, isn't it? I mean, you got to specify the exact chapter and verse of your legal citation. I mean, right there in front of the jury in the heat of the trial. I mean, don't we always look to the underlying basis for whether there was law that might apply to that?
Not when you're asking, as here, to be entitled to greater protection under the state constitution. And at least the courts of appeals have said that that's not good enough. I mean, you've just to make a generic kind of thing. I think that has to be the case here when you're asking for greater protection, because the assumption is, and the presumption is, that you're talking about the federal, because in most federal constitution, because in most instances they're coextensive. In Colorado, where from time to time, this court has granted greater protections under the state constitution, but that's the exception, not the rule. And if you're going to ask the court, the trial court, court of appeals, Supreme Court, for greater protection, you've got to give the trial court the first opportunity.
Chris, can I ask you a question about putting aside the issues you just raised for a minute, and also putting aside whether it violates a constitutional right for state constitutional right. Don't you think that use of the word tailoring in closing argument has the impact of demeaning, to some extent, the right to testify and the right to be present in court? And I guess I'm not suggesting that the prosecutor's conduct was improper or anything, misconduct. That's really not the point. You have a section in your brief, but I'm not really after that. But it seems to me that it does chill the right to testify. It's also, on the other hand, absolutely true that the defendant is present and does hear. And it's also true that if the advisory witness in a case, usually the prosecution witness, is present and hears, and sometimes, I don't know about in this case, gives significant testimony as well. So, but isn't the use of the term tailoring without specific foundations or specific references that's made at the time, isn't that a practice that we shouldn't want to approve?
Your Honor, as I argue in my brief, and as the majority in Portuando said, it's really...
Well, that was dealing...
It's just stating the obvious.
Wait, let me just interrupt for a minute. That was dealing with whether or not there's a violation of federal constitutional right. They expressed no opinion whatsoever about the actual practice. And my question really goes to the actual practice. Is this a good practice? Is it fair? And is it something that we should approve in one form or another? Putting aside, which I think are substantive issues which you've raised in your brief, the constitutional aspects.
Honestly, I think that it's not the big deal that it's been made out to be. I don't think it's the most effective argument. I didn't make the argument when I was in trial court. I didn't have a situation where it was especially effective. So I don't think a generic argument typically does the prosecution much good. And I think it's possible that it could elicit sympathy for the defendant in a given case. It's possible that jury sees that...
Whether it's effective is one thing. Well, whether we want to encourage it because it might demean the right to testify and the right to be present during the trial is totally different.
And at the same time, while it's not necessarily, I don't think, typically a very effective argument, I don't think it's very harmful to the defendant. Especially, and these facts, the way the trial court dealt with it, clearly not harmful, because the court said, as Justice Rice, as you noticed, that the trial court pointed out after defense counsel said, the second objection, the lead detective had the same opportunity to tailor his testimony. This is improper. Court said, noted, and I'm sure the jury also noted that the detective was present in court during the trial also. Again, it's just...
But the
trial court presented that it's no big deal.
Isn't the problem there that that's wrong? The detective didn't have a right to be there, and the defendant did have a right to be there. They're not parallel.
Well, I think they are, Your Honor, because we're talking about credibility here, and the jury's taking the situation as it presented itself, as it presents itself in all trials, that the advisory witness is there throughout the trial and had the opportunity to hear all the witnesses and tailor his testimony. Had the opportunity. We're not talking about, and it's the critical thing here is that we're talking about credibility, impeachment, not inference of guilt. There is, at no time did the prosecutor even suggest that we're talking about the inference of guilt here. That's the difference between this case and Griffin. There, the trial court solemnized, specifically instructed the jury that it could consider the defendant's failure to testify as evidence of the truth of the prosecution's evidence.
That's not what's
happening here.
Here's what concerns me, though, is that lawyer said, the prosecution said something along the lines that the defendant had an advantage when he testified, and that his advantage was that he was able to sit in for the entire time. That's concerning, because he didn't really have an advantage, that he had a right. And he's suggesting that, well, because the defendant gets to sit in, he especially has this advantage, and therefore we're going to give him, you need to look at his credibility differently than you would anybody else. And in a sense, that's what makes the judge's reference to the detective kind of concerning, in my mind, opposite of what you're saying.
Well, again, Your Honor, I think that what the trial court was saying, and I think correctly, was that the advisory witness had the same advantage.
But he didn't have the same right, as Justice Mularkey pointed out. And, so this whole concept of advantage is what's worrisome. We're calling it tailoring. I mean, that's a nice shorthand way to talk about what happened. But really, the prosecution is saying you can't judge the defendant's credibility as truthful as or not, or as being truthful, because he's had this advantage. And he's had an advantage that maybe everybody else didn't, except according to the judge, the detective. And therefore, you have to judge the defendant's credibility more harshly. And that goes essentially to the right, doesn't it, to be present in the courtroom?
Again, I think it does nothing more than the state to give voice to the obvious. That's all that's happening here. Is it a burden? It's no more. It's certainly no more of a burden than being able to instruct the jury that defendant as a witness, the jury can judge the defendant's credibility because the defendant has an interest in the outcome. We've said that's proper going back to 1969.
Well, it's not an interest; it's an advantage.
I mean,
you need to look at the language of the transcript, because the word advantage is what is of concern to me.
And if we're going to look at it,
the prosecutor says, in addition to all of that, ladies and gentlemen, the defense counsel was adamant that his client was so truthful. Well, he's had kind of an advantage, hasn't he? He's been able to sit in here the whole time and listen to what everybody had to say. I mean, isn't the import of that, contrary to the argument that he was being truthful, he had this advantage and he was able to make things up, and the advantage was that he was able to be there the entire time.
Of course, the trial prosecutor didn't ask the jury to draw the inference. We're talking about the difference between opportunity and actually terror. Now, it was a little closer when the prosecutor resumed. He said he was able to tailor his statement. Now, that's able. I mean, that suggests opportunity, but it's a little closer. But defense counsel interpreted that for the jury to say the lead detective had the same opportunity. And the trial court said, noted. So it's that one statement that gives, to me, is most concerning, if not to the point where I think there's anything untoward here. But I think that's the closest the prosecutor came. And again, I think that was blunted by by what the defense counsel said, how the defense counsel's interpretations by saying the lead detective had the same opportunity. I mean, there could be a case where this is important, on a he said, she said kind of case, where the case is the credibility, then I would be more concerned, and this court should be more concerned. That's not the case here. This is not a he said, she said case. We had an eyewitness that saw the defendant leave the car with a big flashlight, and that was the victim's friend. We had a videotape that shows defendant raising his hand, not with a punch, as he said, but overhand. That's on the video. There was strong evidence here.
It's extremely rare for a defendant to get up and testify, isn't it? I mean,
it's yes.
Why is that?
Well, various reasons.
Okay, so we have one.
Prior convictions.
We have an unusual case here, right?
Yes.
Right. So he gets up and he exercises his constitutional right to sit at the trial, and the prosecutor says, "Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you know he was able to sit here. He's a liar. Don't listen to him because he tailored his testimony. Right. He's manipulating you without any foundation to any evidence whatsoever that occurred."
Well, the trial.
Now, if at best, that's a cheap shot, right? At worst, that is a deterrent for anybody to have a gumption to get up and exercise their right to testify in front of the jury, because you're going to get slapped down by the state for doing that. Isn't that really the outcome of what happened here?
No, Your Honor. We're talking about, again, you're not being slapped down by stating the obvious.
The obvious is he's in the courtroom.
That right? He's had the opportunity. He's sat there the whole time. I mean,
right.
You know, in any event, I think that
apparently the framers of our Constitution thought that was important, right?
Well, this court has never interpreted the language, appearing defendant person, to go, they've interpreted, this court has interpreted coextensively with the right of self-representation. It's never found that the right to appearing defendant person has meant any more than the right for self-representation. Now, I mean, I think this court certainly could, but this court never has. It's never been interpreted more broadly. So there is no state constitutional right. Majority of the U.S. Supreme Court has said there's no federal constitutional right involved here, that there's been no violation of the federal constitutional right. And this is also a situation where the court did point out to the jury that it would be clearly unconstitutional to prohibit pointed out to the jury that the defendant has a constitutional right, and in no sense is being demeaned. So if this court ultimately finds that it was error, it is certainly harmless here. Unless the court has any other questions, I just thank you for your time and ask you to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. No one was unclear that the rights at stake were preserved in this particular case, and so we would ask that the court find that the constitutional right to be present was actually preserved in this particular case. Secondly, with regard to opportunity, the court should pause in allowing the prosecution to condemn the opportunity to do something when they don't have any factual basis with respect to proper impeachment or actual facts that undermine or indicate a lack of credibility. And so for those reasons and the reasons I stated earlier, we would ask the court to reverse the Court of Appeals decision. Thank you.
On behalf of the court, I thank you both counsel for your arguments. The case stands submitted, and the court will go.